folks.
I have the opportunity now to have a conversation with someone I admire greatly, and I think you probably already know this man. I've decided to bring him in as part of a series of conversations I'm having with people about some fundamental, maybe differences of viewpoint, differing feelings, in fact, if we want to use that term, that people have, that sort of gut reaction people have, who these folks might not be on our side necessarily as libertarians or left-leaning libertarians or anarcho-capitalists or anything like that. They might be more statist, whether they're the right-wing statist type of person or the left-wing statist type of person. And yet, oftentimes, they'll state that their goals are the same. You know, they're hoping for the same kinds of things as we are. Greater freedom for people and better lives for people and things like that. Better living standards. So I started to think, you know, what are some of the ways in which we disagree? Where are these disagreements? And I thought, I realized that sometimes we're not even starting from the same definitional base. The terminology we're using, they see the terms differently than we see the terms. And I mentioned on the radio program recently the term exploitation. I talked a little bit about Marx's exploitation theory and how Baum Bavirk was able to explain why that was wrong in many ways and show how things like interests and a time preference on money are important factors to consider when we're looking at economics. And I wanted to take the opportunity now to turn to a person who has a great handle on this sort of thing and more. And today we're going to talk about one term in particular. He is, of course, Sheldon Richman, who's been on the program numerous times in the past, has led me to great insights, and his work can be seen everywhere. You can see great videos of him speaking on YouTube. You know his work as editor of the Freeman for quite a while. He is now the vice president and editor at the Future of Freedom Foundation. And so I hope you'll look for their work. They have numerous publications you can check out. And I'm really glad that Sheldon is expanding the amount that he's writing for FFF. And also, you can find his work. He's probably one of the most published libertarian, pro-free market economics writers of the 20th or 21st century. And he's with us right now, Sheldon Richman. Welcome, Sheldon.
Well, thanks, Art, for inviting me. It's always a pleasure.
It's a pleasure to have you here. Sheldon, before the recording, you and I were chatting just briefly about this difference in terminology and the viewpoints on terms. And this is one of the things I began to realize. I'm sure you've probably seen this for a while, because you often tailor your speeches, your conversations, or your articles on pinpointing areas where a left statist or a right statist might have certain assumptions and saying, oh, well, you know, you might want to maybe give it another thought. Look at it this way. And so when we look at definitions of things, I want to look at something you've discussed in great detail, and I think you've done a fantastic job. The sort of almost instantaneous response that people have today to the idea that the United States economy, in the economy of almost any westernized world, a westernized nation, is somehow a capitalist economy. And the very term capitalism is something on which I want to concentrate, especially for the left-leaning statists out there. They might think that, yes, you know, without the government, capitalism, per se, would run rampant. And we can already see how corrupt the system is. Can you tell us a little bit about your view of the term capitalism and how you've tried to explain to people that maybe they might want to take a second look at this term?
Sure, and it's a big subject because it involves semantics and history and a lot of other things, but it is certainly worth looking at because there's so much confusion about the word.
Mm.
I mean, people use it to mean all sorts of things. There was a few years ago, there was an article by Stephen Kinzer who was talking about countries in Latin America and the Caribbean, and he was calling them all capitalist, except for Cuba and probably Venezuela. So, you know, Haiti he called capitalist, and Guatemala he called capitalist, Honduras, Dominican Republic. And, and it was clear what he meant by capitalist was simply any system that wasn't avowedly Marxist. So it became just a grab bag, right, for every other system.
Right.
You know, because there's nominally private property, I guess, but he didn't care that it was only nominal, that, you know, as long as property on the in terms of law was in private hands, it didn't matter how much government regulated it or managed it, or how, or whether the owners, the private owners, were actually, you know, cronies of the people in power. That didn't matter for him. All that mattered was nominally it was private, therefore it was capitalist.
Yes.
And, you know, so you really had two choices, you know, sort of Marxism and capitalism.
Yeah, right.
And
right.
That's pretty silly, because there's too much variation in his capitalist category for it to be very useful.
Right. It's sort of like saying anything that is not an amphibian, it must be a bipedal human.
Yeah, more or less. And yeah. It sows confusion, and it lets people. And here's the problem, and this is the problem that I and my my colleagues like to point out. It lets people who don't like the bad things that they see going on in the U.S. economy, things that they find regrettable, it lets people blame that on the free market, because you have, you know, you have other people saying, well, capitalism means the free market. So they hear the other side hears that. Let's just call it the left for convenience sake.
Mm.
They hear that and say, okay, so if we find things we don't like in the current American economy, which is described as capitalist, we're going to blame that on the free market, and therefore we don't want any part of the free market. So the baby's getting thrown out with the bathwater. So this
right.
is, we're really trying to make making an attempt here to clarify our thinking, so that we're blaming the right thing, you know, for rather than the wrong thing for something that we think is blameworthy.
Right.
That's where the confusion comes in. So we're trying to separate it. Now, some people say, well, okay, let's clear up the confusion by insisting that capitalism means the free market, and don't let other people get away with using it to describe the current economy.
That's one of the mistakes that I made. I was in a conversation in 2002 with some friends of mine over in the UK, and they said, oh, you're a capitalist system. I said, well, no, what we've got is mercantilism in the United States. It's a sort of crony capitalism. It's corporate capitalism, the kind of thing Adam Smith warned about in the 1770s. We don't have straight capitalism. But even I was really going down the wrong path on the second part of it, which is adhering to the term capitalism in a way, right?
Well, I think so, because it doesn't seem to pay any dividends to be saying, well, what capitalism really means is, because what does that mean to say what it really means? We don't have definitions in a Platonic world somewhere, right, that we consult and say, okay, yeah, capitalism really means something else. I mean, words acquire their meaning through usage.
Right.
Again, there's not some Platonic realm that we consult and say, here's the real definition.
This is the pure word, capitalism.
Now, advocates of the free market will readily admit or concede or acknowledge, it's not something to admit, but acknowledge that there's never been a free market.
Yeah.
There's always been a mix, a mercantilist some features that would look like a free market, but too badly mixed up with government intervention and cronyism and all that stuff. So they're happy to admit there's never been a free market. So why do we want to call any? You know, we can't then say if they believe the free market is capitalism, then they have to say capitalism has never existed.
Mm.
But that goes against so much usage. People believe capitalism has existed.
Mm-hmm.
And to add another historical point to this, you can go back to the early 19th century and probably before that and find advocates of the free market using the word capitalist, if not the word capitalism, disparagingly.
Yes,
because in those days, the radical free market people, and I have in mind, I can't think of his first name now. Hodgkin.
Yeah.
Uh, th- Thomas Hodgkin, sorry, who was a founding editor of The Economist magazine and something of a mentor to Herbert Spencer.
Mm.
He was a laissez-faire advocate, essentially an anarchist. I mean, he doesn't really seem to leave any room for government at all.
Yeah.
But he's an individualist who believes in the private property, as long as it's not property handed out by states, by governments, to cronies.
Yeah.
So, you know, his credentials for being a pro-market person cannot be questioned. And yet he thought of capitalism as a system in which government gives privileges to owners of capital.
Uh-huh.
So when he talked about the capitalist class, you may, if you didn't know anything, you'd say, oh, this guy's a Marxist. And he's sometimes called a socialist or a Cartesian socialist.
Because, right.
You know, he's pre-Austrian, so he's under the influence of Adam Smith and Ricardo. I've read that he actually admired Smith more than Ricardo, but some reason this Ricardian socialist label sticks to him. But he's not a socialist in the sense of he wants the government to own the means of production or operate the means of production. He is a pro-market individualist. You know, The Economist begins as a very hardcore laissez-faire magazine. It's come a long way since then.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, he's not the first to use the word capitalist in a disparaging way, or to think of capitalism as a system that privileges capital.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say a system, I mean a political system. The
yeah.
government is doing the privileging through various things, tariffs, licensing, patents, various things. And you can see this then also in the United States, in the thinkers that surrounded Liberty Magazine, which was a magazine that was published in the late 19th century into the 20th century, edited by Benjamin Tucker.
Sure.
Lysander Spooner wrote for the magazine.
Yeah.
In its early days. Well, he had a whole circle of people around him, Tucker did, and they were anti-capitalist. They were against capitalism, but capitalism back then, again, meant a system in which capital is privileged by the state and that competition is stifled because of this privilege.
So in a way, Sheldon, in a way, the very accusations that I was hearing over in England when I was in London, even though they might not have realized it, they were actually apropos in a way, weren't they?
Well, yeah, that's right. I mean, we got to keep the ideas and the events straight.
Yeah.
But for a good part of history, after the Industrial Revolution, capitalism was not a word that was looked on with favor by advocates of free markets.
Right.
And if you think about it, that makes complete sense, because if we were starting fresh and we didn't have a name, we're looking for a new name for the free market. We're all sitting around. And we're fans of the free market, thinking, you know, we need a one word name. Free market's good, but it's two words. We need one word.
Right.
And we were kicking names around, and someone said, "Well, I got one: capitalism."
Right.
You know, it seems to me we'd say, "Well, that doesn't make any sense. Why do we want to single out one factor of production and call it that?"
Yes, yes,
of course, capital has a couple of meanings. It can mean machines, right? Machinery and produced goods that are used to produce other goods.
Yeah.
But every economic system has that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not unique. Now, you know, Mises said, you know, that money capital is an idea that you only have in under the free market. But that still wouldn't justify naming the system after that. It seems like you'd want to not name it after one thing, because it does sound like this should get special treatment.
Yeah.
Why not call it laborism? Why not call it landism?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely right. That's a great, great point. And it's fascinating, Sheldon, to see the way that the word has changed over the years, so that a person in 2002 could be thinking that he's using a word, capitalism, which all along, in my innocent view, I thought was akin to free markets. And other people could be using it, not realizing that they were using it in a sense that it had been used 100 years before, when it was used as a pejorative for more of a mercantilist type of a system. It's absolutely fascinating the way the word has been redefined over the years.
Yeah. No, that's right. And, you know, there was an article I was surprised to find just by accident in the Freeman, which I used to edit for in the mid-80s, about in 1985, written by a historian who wrote published a great deal in the Freeman over the years, must have been close to Leonard Reed, named Clarence Carson.
Oh, Clarence Carson, sure.
He was a sort of libertarian, maybe somewhat on the conservative side, wrote a lot of books against communism and the Soviet Union. It was, you know, that kind of stuff we sort of grew up on.
Mm.
And he had an article in the mid-80s called Capitalism, Yes or No. And what he argues in there, that he argues that it's not a good, very good name, and I was astounded that somebody, you know, at Fee in the mid-80s was saying this.
Mm.
He says it's not a good word, it lends itself to misunderstanding, it's not very descriptive. He said if you want to call any country, and don't forget he's writing at during the Cold War, if you want to call any country capitalist, he said I'd call the Soviet Union capitalist.
Oh,
and
wow.
Under Stalin, they were willing to murder millions of people in order to accumulate capital, right? Big industry.
Right.
Look what Stalin did to build, you know, to build major industry. He was willing to collectivize the farms, starve people who wouldn't cooperate, and walk over people in order to build great industry, because he thought, you know, this was going to be the great leap for the Soviet Union. That was an obsession with capital. So Carson here saying they should be called capitalists, not a free market. So that really, in one article, really put so much of the argument that I'm and other people are making. And he did it again under the auspices of Fee. In 1985, so this is not even a new position that we're taking. It's something that has been on some people's mind. Hayek also thought it was an unfortunate word.
Well, it's interesting, the insights that you provide and these other writers have provided. It's very interesting to hear you say these things, Sheldon. You know, looking at the word capitalism, as you mentioned, how it seems to exclude other factors in the economy. And I think contemporary views of capitalism tend to view it just as the money holders, capitalism, as in capital, as in money. As you mentioned, capital has a lot of other types of things to which it applies. And so I think they see it as big money people, and they are getting their way, and they don't like that. And I think that it's quite interesting to see how you've been able to dig through the history and find that so many years ago, capitalism was sort of seen as the big money people, the landed aristocracy, or the big business people getting favors through tariffs and things like that from the government. It's amazing, because these are things that I didn't know until I started to read things that you had written and start to talk to you about the historical changes in the word capitalism. It's fascinating.
Well, that's right. It is fascinating, because most people just don't ever look at it, and they use the word in a murky way. Like you said at one point, the word, it's an odd word, capitalism, that can take either free market as a modifier, or state or crony capitalism as a modifier. In other words, it can mean two opposite things. It doesn't seem to me, it doesn't mean free market, because you would never say crony free market.
Yeah.
or state free market.
Right.
And so capitalism, if it can take either qualifier, then it must be more neutral. It just means, non-state socialist, I guess. That's about the only thing, sort of like Kinzer was doing in his article. He was just using it as a not much content. It just ruled out kind of one thing, right? Namely, state socialism, sort of Marxist-style state socialism.
Yeah.
Everything else then gets called capitalism.
Yeah.
And, you know, some capitalist countries may be free, and some capitalist countries may not be free. Well, that's not a good word, then, to mean the free market, because you have to keep insisting, well, I don't mean what we have today, I mean the free market.
Mm.
So why not just be done with it? Don't use the word. And free market's a lot harder to understand. I mean, we've taken to even say freed market with a D at the end, to try to point out that we don't say what we have today is free.
Right.
We're looking forward to the time, hopefully not too long, when it will be freed.
Yeah. Sheldon, maybe for some of the folks who are just approaching our libertarian views, could you explain to some people, that maybe draw the distinctions between what we see today with this bizarre mixed economy that the United States operates through the politicization of business and tariffs and things like that, and what a view of free market might be.
Well, sure.
I know it's very broad. I know.
Right. I mean, a free market is actually, you know, is not a difficult idea. I mean, obviously the market itself is very complex. In a way that, you know, no individual can completely comprehend, because it's so complex. It's just social processes are beyond, this is one of F.A. Hayek's big points, right? It's beyond the power of any individual mind to conceive and therefore to plan.
Yeah.
It's just too complicated, right? There's too many things that are inaccessible. Your subjective expectations and preferences are not going to be accessible to a central planner. It's not something you could put into a computer into equations, and so you know, it's just too complicated and beyond our reach.
Yeah.
But what it means, I mean, we can describe it sort of in simple terms, and it simply means that each individual is recognized as owning himself or herself, and therefore may do as he or she likes. With basically the one prohibition that, you know, no use of force or fraud with respect to other people, because other people are not your property.
Mm-hmm.
You can't treat people merely as merely as means to your ends, but also as ends in themselves. So it can be stated simply. If you follow that, you get a very complex system. But the rules are not difficult. On the other hand, the opposite is where the machinery of force, which is government, I mean, government in any society is essentially the one institution or organization that can legally use force against, can use aggressive force.
Mm.
In other words, you know, you and I can use force legally in self-defense, but we can't use force against other people who have not used it first against us.
Right, we're not going to initiate it.
Even if our motives are good, right?
Yeah.
You can't go to your next door neighbor with a gun and say, "Give me 10% of your income because I want to feed the hungry."
Right, right.
And if he says, "Well, no, no, thanks, I'll take care of that myself," and you say, "Well, no, it wasn't a request."
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. And then afterwards, say, "Oh, and by the way, this means you care."
Yeah.
I love that one.
If you try to do that today, you'll get arrested. I mean,
yeah.
Really so. You'll get arrested. You violated that person's that person's rights.
Yeah.
So the government is the only agency that can use aggressive force. So it can go to us and say, surrender 10% or actually more than that, 25%. They want to bring it up to, 40%?
Yeah.
Of your income, because we want to do other things with it. You can't legally refuse, because if you do that, you're going to go to jail.
Mm-hmm.
So the opposite of a free market is an economic system, and there's a lot of variations, but it's an economic system in which the government is going to use its power to use aggressive force against peaceful people who have not violated anybody's rights, in order to bring about various political and economic outcomes. So they may regulate wages, they may regulate prices, they may impose regulations on how you can produce certain goods, you know, all kinds of things that go beyond self-defense or defense of innocent people. So that's the big division.
Now, Sheldon, some of the left-leaning folks out there who believe that the state is necessary, they might hear us talking and they'll say, "Yeah, but you know, it's the big companies that make it necessary. It's the big business people that make it necessary. It's the potential that they're going to exploit someone that make it necessary for us to have what we think is a counterweight to it, which is the state, which is that entity which somehow, I might be adding my own sort of coloring to this, but somehow will, through this metaphysical means, balance it out and make things fair." And what they mean is through legislation doing certain things. They think that it's necessary to have that because they think that if something gets big, it can exploit and harm people, and that the free market is dangerous in that way. I know that also is a very broad topic, but to me, it ties into their views of capitalism. Today they see what we have today as unfettered free markets. We know that it is not. It is really a more mercantilist situation, regulated economy, giving favors, corporate crony capitalism, things like that. But even if we are to show them that what we have today is not a free market, their worries tend to sort of roll back to sort of a default position, in my opinion. You've probably seen this as well, where they say, well, yeah, but if there weren't these government controls, even though we've already explained to them that having the government there just tends to make things worse and so on and gives you this corporate cronyism problem. They say, well, you know, if it were just handled right, then we could stop those bad guys. Even in the free markets, you have to have government because people are going to be exploited. That's a big deal to me, and it's a very big topic, but it's my opinion, and I think it's empirically observable, that through freedom, through the division of labor, the very simple division of labor, I mean, we don't have, in teaching basic economics classes, you don't see someone sitting there saying, yeah, if only there was some Platonic watcher who were there at the very beginning of the division of labor to actually assign what labors would be divided amongst whom. That would have been much better. I don't know how you would take on the worries of a left statist like that to say, listen, the free market leads to better outcomes than what you yep. think it does. Any thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, we need to approach it in a couple directions. One is to explain why the things the person is worried about don't flow from the market. In fact, they precisely flow from government intervention. In other words, we can enlist a public choice school to show that government, even in a democracy, or maybe particularly in a democracy, will tend to favor special interests, and that the mass of people won't have the kind of access to power that well-connected people will have. This has been illustrated in George Stigler's rule of capture. You know, regulatory agencies inevitably tend to be dominated by the ones they regulate.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and there's reasons for that. It's not just that it's bribery or outright corruption. It's that the industry has the information, right? It has the technical information. They're going to be relied on by the regulators. And then there's also things that are a little less savory. Regulators may be looking forward to the day when they're going to retire from their government job and maybe want consulting work or a staff position in the industry they're regulating.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, they know something. They could be a good liaison to the government, right? They've been a regulator.
Absolutely. We just saw one of...
This is in the back of their mind.
Yep.
So in other words, the left, we need to show the good faith leftist that he has this Pollyanna view of government. It's what the economist Harold Demsetz called the Nirvana. It's the Nirvana fallacy. It's assuming that the government is going to be that person's ideal.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, they look at the market and say, well, the market is filled with real world people, some of whom are corrupt and not nice, and so we're going to get this messiness. But they're doing an unfair comparison, right? They're comparing something that seems rooted in the real world, because there are rotten people.
Yeah.
And plus, people don't have full knowledge, so they're both somewhat ignorant, and then some are rotten. So they're taking one side that's, you know, has some realistic features, and what are they comparing it to? This totally unrealistic thing that they're calling the state, which has never behaved that way in any throughout history,
mm-hmm.
and we can show them why it doesn't behave that way. In other words, they got to do a fair comparison: real world government to real world markets.
Yes.
Instead,
absolutely.
They do this idealized image of government, almost this platonic government,
mm-hmm.
versus. That's rooted in the real world, and of course their system wins the contest because they've already assumed perfection on the part of their choice. But when you factor in public choice and other criticisms of this, we realize that government doesn't work the way they say it's going to work.
Right.
It works on the basis of cronyism and paying off friends, and regular people don't really have access, and one vote doesn't count. I hate to shatter their illusions. I know that the Chris Matthews hearing this would probably have an aneurysm or something. But one vote doesn't count.
No.
A single vote counts. Unless you live in a very tiny town of three people, chances are your vote is not going to break a tie in any election.
No.
You have a better chance of getting hit by a car and in a fatal crash on the way to the polls than to make a difference in the election. Any one person in this country can look himself in the mirror and say, if that person stayed home on election day, or went, let's say they didn't vote, went to the polls on election day, this past election day, that person would have made no difference whatsoever. And that's true for any one of us. So our cloud is almost non-existent.
That's right.
Of course, politicians that get reelected have to appear to be doing things because they need enough people to come out and vote. They need a lot of votes. They don't need any one vote, but they need a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
But that's more cosmetic. Mainly what they're doing is cultivating constituencies and special interests that can finance their campaigns and keep them in power. And there's this harmony of interest between the elite, the governing elite, and the people in government, because they're going to need each other.
Oh, yes. And, Sheldon, I've often tried to tell folks on the radio that if they're truly interested in the so-called will of the people, we often hear that the vote means that it's the will of the people, which it clearly does not. But, in a softer approach, I try to say, look, if you really want to see the will of the people, then allow the people to express themselves individually, truly, and allow their choice to remain. Don't just allow the 51% of the 30% who have voted to be the ones who direct everything for everybody later, or the representatives that they choose. I said, if you really want the will of the people, the will of the people is shown by each person showing his will. And if you think that there's some financial or economic discrepancy that means it's more difficult for some poorer people to be able to express their will in the marketplace, then don't worry about it, because business people are always trying to reach that person. The competitive market will try to get things to that person to allow him to have a choice. And if they are going to rely on a government system to somehow express their will, well, they're going to be, unfortunately, sadly mistaken, because the incentives are for the people with the concentrated wealth to be able to use that system to continue to amass their wealth and take advantage of that political system, and they're not going to be able to change it.
Well, that's right. And so we can now flip the coin and say, what if those people, those influential people, don't have political power to have, don't have access to political power?
Great point. Yes.
And even assuming the worst motives, let's say they want to exploit consumers and they want to exploit employees, what will they do? Or will they quickly realize the best way to make money is to produce things lots of people want?
Yes.
How will they go about exploiting? If they cheat people, they'll get a reputation for cheating. And of course, there would be recourse to courts for fraud and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But if they want to pay workers too low, how are they going to stop somebody else coming along and offering jobs at a higher wage? Or how are they going to stop the workers themselves from deciding to go, become self-employed? Because there won't be any of the barriers to self-employment. Licensing, huge number of professions require licenses.
Oh yeah, and those are
We're not just talking about doctors, right?
Yep.
People with highly technical information, but we're talking about women who, braid hair.
Oh yeah,
And they're undertakers and florists in Louisiana. I think you need a license to be a florist.
Yeah,
because we have these rogue florists out there taking advantage of the consumers and not telling them that roses have thorns. Careful, not telling them to be careful when they handle the roses because they may get stuck.
Yep. Absolutely.
So self-employment is the barriers to self-employment are great. I'm not saying they're impossible or insurmountable, but they're high. And so, if somebody is not offering a decent pay in the eyes of the particular person looking for a job, he could always, as a last resort, try to start a business or go into a partnership with a couple of his other fellow workers who aren't happy, or even some sort of worker managed co-op or something like that, which Herbert Spencer was a big fan of worker-owned firms.
Yeah, yeah, that's
he foresaw the day when that would be the dominant form of of employment.
Well, you know, Sheldon, in one of your terrific speeches, and I didn't think that we might go into this detail, but in one of your great speeches, you mentioned in it that you look back a little bit at history, and you mentioned that Kevin Carson wrote some notes on the enclosure of the open fields under the Tudors in the Middle Ages and how the landed aristocracy came around. And you mentioned Belloc speaks about that. And I think a lot of the Georgists over in the UK would probably appreciate that. Henry VIII taking farmed land where people had basically formed their own de facto land rights by working the land. They weren't written down in law. They weren't de jure, but they were de facto rights to each other, and the land was just taken and then was handed out to the landed aristocracy. And you mentioned how Eleanor Ostrom has shown that the commons can be managed without the state, that customs arise, they're worked out by people. And that's a sort of a similar thing, I think, that when you know, people can form any associations they want to form when they're making trying to find their way to make their own livings and prosper. And there would be all sorts of things if the state didn't direct things in so many fashions, right?
Well, no, that's right, and it's good that you mentioned Ostrom, because she's, you know, there are some libertarians and free market economists, especially around George Mason, who are huge fans of hers, but other people don't. Other libertarians, I think, aren't quite sure about her because she doesn't speak quite the same language that libertarians traditionally speak of. I mean, she does talk about common pool resources being managed by a community, not by the government, but by the people who, you know, who are involved in it, rather than through one person owning it.
So it's still voluntary, and that's the thing. It's still based on each individual making a choice. So it's not a forced situation, and I think that's one of the key insights. It's voluntary that these people, it's a voluntary way these people come together.
That's right. It is voluntary, and they create rules and forms of governance, often without the government being anywhere near it. And she points out how the bureaucrats usually don't understand the rules. They're complex and they're local and they're based on longstanding custom. And, you know, when the bureaucrat comes from the distant capital, he thinks he understands it, but he doesn't really.
Yeah.
And then often messes it up. But that's just people, right? That's part of the market, because that's just people working things out through peaceful cooperation.
Exactly.
That's all it is. It doesn't say the market isn't locked into this one model of, you know, one person, one parcel.
Right. Right.
It need not be that. Yeah. And the Kevin Carson and other left libertarians were critical of, you know, they look back at the enclosure of lands in England, not as being a liberal advance in the sense of libertarian advance, which some libertarians think it was, because they say, well, no, it went from commons to private ownership. That was a good move. But in fact, it was more; those things were more like Ostromite arrangements, and the government instead intervened and said, we don't like this, and they organized it around private ownership. But very often, the cronies got the best land,
right.
and a lot of peasants were displaced from land they had worked for many generations, and then they had no choice but to go into the cities. I mean, Hayek concedes this. They then go in the cities and look for, and Mises, looking for employment in the new factories. But they left the land not because they wanted to leave the land, but because they got kicked off the land. And Mises talks about this in, I think it's in Socialism, where he discusses this.
Well, this is terrific, Sheldon. I'm really so happy that I've gotten you on here, and I didn't expect that we'd cover these chunks in the ways that we have, but I hope people appreciate these, because they're first historically fascinating, but also there's a theme of morality in every one of these examples, and the morality is individual choice, individual liberty. And one of the things that I'd like to bring up, I've mentioned this a number of times on the radio, Sheldon, and I hope you don't mind, but you know, oftentimes we hear from conservatives, paleoconservatives in particular, sort of Burkean conservatives, morality is not subjective. We hear the term often that they decry moral relativism. And what I try to point out is that we are all subjective creatures. It just so happens to me, I seem to observe that most people tend to like bettering their lives and living longer and being healthy and gaining pleasure in whatever way that they seem to find it. And in many cases, these things tend to revolve around some commonly determined or organically determined modes of behavior. That in society, people tend to congregate with people who are non-aggressive towards them, who will help them, who are good people, and we tend to shun or get away from the people who are aggressive and will try to manipulate our lives. This just is something that I think is observable, whether one wants to define things as the state of nature or not the state of nature. I believe John Locke was incorrect in his approach to the state of nature. I think in the state of nature, individuals themselves, without the state, form their own associations and have their own systems that tend to show that people like to congregate with people who are non-aggressive, that they try to get away from others or protect themselves from others who might defraud them and things like that. And they're always striving to better their lives. And this is the sort of approach that really fascinates me, because I say to myself, in all these instances, a left statist who I think probably has the same goals in many cases that I do, could be convinced by hearing what you say, by the historical things that you bring up, to say, yeah, you know, we're probably not that far apart from each other. And all we need to do is continue to try to convince them that the big enemy is the machine of legalized force, of legal initiation of aggression, that blocks these formations from occurring, or takes these formations and tears them apart. Am I off base here?
No, I think that's exactly the way to go.
Okay.
You know, there are people, I'm sure, among leftists who will never be convinced because they just don't like market activity or making money, no matter how you make it. There's just some aversion to that. Maybe it's even aesthetic, right?
Yeah.
They don't like the idea. But I'm willing to bet there are good faith people out there who don't like the idea of helpless individuals seeming not to be involved in making or who seem to have no influence on things that impinge on their lives. And as a libertarian, we should say, yeah, you should have some say over the things that impinge on your lives. So the question is, and I'm actually writing an article about this for tomorrow's FFF website, The question is which social arrangement gives the individual more say over those things that will affect him? The political system, and for the reasons we discussed, I think the answer is no to the political system, because no individual, unless he's very wealthy and well-connected, is going to have any measurable clout. Or the marketplace, where you get to... You know, when you go into a store and see all those products and you decide to buy one, Wheaties rather than Cheerios, you get Wheaties. You don't have to wait for the vote to be taken and at the end of the day find out which one you're getting. Right? It's not voting like that. In a sense, it's voting because you have your, you know, $3 or whatever it is, and you say, okay, I vote for Wheaties, and you take it off the shelf and you take it home.
Yes.
In a political system, you cast your one vote, which doesn't mean anything, then you go home and watch TV to see which one you're stuck with.
Oh, yes. And Sheldon, one of the things I'd like to bring up, someone might say, yes, but in that system, the poor people don't have as much say as the rich. But my point to them would be, the business person is always going to try to be able to get a product to a person, even on that low margin. The market tends to try to get things to as many people as possible, even people who don't have as much to spend. That's why they're always fighting to try to beat the other guy, or in lowering prices and keeping quality consistent or improving it. So that's why poor people who might have been seen as poor can now vote on DVD players. Where in the past, if you want to use the term vote, in the past, they might have been a little too expensive for them to vote on at that time. But the market allows them eventually to do it. Is that an incorrect thing to say, too? I sort of defer to you as my guru in many ways.
No, I think that's fair. Look, while we don't want to underestimate the amount of intervention there is in the in today's economy.
Yeah, right.
Of a corporatist or cronyist nature, we should be willing to point out I mean, we shouldn't shy away from the fact that there still are enough elements of competition, at least certainly in some industries, that we see the results. We see something similar to what we would see in a purely free market. And one of those things is how prices do fall over time. I mean, everybody, if you're my age, you remember how expensive it was to buy a videotape recorder.
Yeah.
In the 80s, right? Yeah. mid-80s. It might cost you $800 for a home recorder. Now you can get a DVD, which is better, or Blu-ray, whatever, but let's go to DVDs, which are superior to tape, because tapes can get broken and unravel and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
DVDs are much better. You can jump around. You couldn't jump around with a tape. You had to run, you know, fast forward or fast rewind. But how much does a DVD player cost these days? Under $50, right?
Right, right. Absolutely.
This is the case. I mean, things fall with respect to our incomes. In other words, so our dollars. Unless the government mucks things up by inflating the economy, the currency.
Right.
But if it's not doing that, we tend to see productivity increase, the learning curve has climbed by producers, and goods come down in price. So originally only the wealthy can buy things, but as time goes on, and you know, a relatively short time, things come within the grasp of most people. Almost everybody has a cell phone today.
Right.
A few years ago, only the wealthy...
Right.
If you go back and look at the Wall Street movie with Michael Douglas, that was the 80s, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, he had that big brick of a phone, and that was a prestige item.
Yeah, yeah, you could have put
the average person wasn't walking around with that big, heavy thing anyway.
Absolutely.
You know, you can get for $50, and sometimes even less than that, more computing power in your palm of your hand than they had on Apollo 11, they always say.
Yeah.
And that's within so many people reach. Go out on the street and you'll see people of all socioeconomic stations walking around talking on the telephone. And this is with all the drags on the economy from the government. Imagine if those drags didn't exist. So this idea that the poor, first of all, you know, the government keeps people poor.
Yes, yes.
Through ways that would, you know, right now I guess would take us too much time to go through. But the minimum wage and all kinds of things that are that block people from getting out of poverty. So the government creates poor people. Then of course. Or keeps them poor. A crappy education system is another example.
Yeah.
But then it makes a big show of how helpful it is and compassionate it is to the poor. The same poor it's keeping down.
It keeps
people poor, and then shows great compassion in throwing them some crumbs. So there wouldn't be as many poor in a truly free market.
Absolutely right, Sheldon. You cover so many of the bases, and just talking about that wage story, the minimum wage requirements that the government places on various businesses, that's another topic that I would love to get into in further detail, because I have numerous friends who still don't understand just what the minimum wage does.
Yep.
And it would be great to be able to talk about that. To sort of close things off, everyone, I know that, you know, Sheldon, folks, has stayed even longer than I had asked him. And Sheldon, thanks. It's really, really.
Jordan.
Oh, it's great. It's so great, man. I wish you were here right now and, you know, you could pick up the bass and, you know, we'd start jamming around or something like that. He's a good musician too, folks. I just wanted to mention, you had at the sort of round this off, you were talking about how people are mistaken if they think that by turning to the government, they're going to somehow stop the big money interests from harming the little guy. And I think that this sort of brings me back to a quote or a point that you made in a recent article you had at the American Conservative, where you said Adam Smith famously wrote in The Wealth of Nations that, quote, people of the same trade seldom meet together, even for merriment and diversion, but the conversation ends in a conspiracy against the public or in some contrivance to raise prices. Now, I think it's so terrific that you make this extra point, and this is what I think is so essential. You say, much less famously, Adam Smith concluded, quote, it is impossible indeed to prevent such meetings by any law which either could be executed or would be consistent with liberty or justice. But though the law cannot hinder people of the same trade from sometimes assembling together, it ought to do nothing to facilitate such assemblies, much less to render them necessary. And if we can take that point and then drive it home by saying, what is the mechanism by which their contrivances to raise prices, what is the only way that they can do that without other competition entering? It is by getting favors from the very government many of the people think will help the little guy.
That's it. Beautifully put, and that sums it up. Of course, we could take a lot of time to explain all the ways, because there are a lot of ways. There's endless ways. They're constantly thinking up new ways.
Yeah.
But what happens is that the well-connected look for ways to keep the competition low, so that they can protect their market share and their profits, and so we can speak the leftist language by putting it that way.
Yes.
But then tracing that power to the state. You know, when Occupy Wall Street first emerged, they were camping out at, you know, at Wall Street in front of you know, the big companies down there. I did a piece that fit on one sheet that I was hoping people would hand out, and I got handed out some places, called Wall Street Couldn't Have Done It Alone. And it was a bunch of bullets. It must have been, I don't know, 10 bulleted points about how, of all the ways government intervened to create the housing and the financial debacle.
Yeah.
Oh. May and Freddie Mac, and you know, all this stuff, and the guarantees to the banks, you know, the too big to fail, all that stuff. They couldn't have done it alone. You can't bail yourself out.
Absolutely, absolutely.
You're a big bank, you can't bail yourself out. Or if you try, you're not going. Who cares? You can ignore them. Let them try to bail themselves out, but they can't. They can't force us to bail them out.
Wow.
Taxpayers.
You've done that. Just doing that to hand out to people is so important. I've seen some folks in conversations, just private conversations, trying to convince people in a hotel lobby. And if they had had something like that, it would have been terrific, Sheldon. You know, oh man. Well, listen. Thanks so much. This is great. And I know you know, having you on here is just a treat for me. I love it. It's fantastic. And I just am so glad that I took the steps to go down and see you and talk to you, and you know, amongst the times that I would go down to Irvington and things like that, and to call you a friend and a guy who's been such a great mentor, it's just awesome. So thanks so much, Sheldon. It's great.
Well, I can just say ditto. It's always been a pleasure to, and I've learned much from you, and I look forward to further conversations of like this.
All right, man. Well, I'll try to think of some other topics. Maybe we'll talk about minimum wage. We'll get more into that exploitation thing, and try to hit those as bullet points as well, or other things that you might have on your mind too. I'd love to bring you on more.
Okay.
Great. Thanks, Sheldon.
Love it. All right. Good talking.
All right.